on WLRN-TV.
91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. South Florida has never been viewed as a low-crime area. We could consider the pirate mayhem from Spanish and English eras, but more conventional criminal activity in our area actually dates from the Civil War. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. A war deserter who slogged or sailed to rugged South Florida had a good chance of survival. To avoid capture, wartime desperados fled here. Jeff Davis had plans to escape abroad from southeastern Florida, but made it only to southern Georgia. We'll pick up from the late 1880s when boomtown Miami appealed to quick buck schemes and frontier saloons, gambling, and prostitution outside the northern city limits. The early 20th century saw racial violence, murder, and crooked sheriffs. That's next after the news. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman on today's Topical Currents. We're in our favorite realm today, Bonnie, South Florida history.
Well, at least yours.
Your favorite realm today is the eclipse.
The eclipse, yes, yes.
Right. Well, we're also with our favorite historian, Dr. Paul George. He's the resident historian at the History Miami Museum.
This is the first in a three-part series focused on the fascinating area of South Florida crime history. Today, we'll cover criminal activity beginning in the wake of the Civil War and into the first quarter of the 20th century. Tuesday's hour is devoted to the criminally active period from the 1930s up until 1960.
Then Wednesday's program highlights more modern crimes up to the present. So we welcome Dr. Paul George, longtime history professor at Miami-Dade College. He also specialized in a myriad of South Florida history tours for many years and still does them.
Plus, we can't forget the many, many Topical Currents history quiz programs over many, many years. Welcome,
I think that
Dr.
Tally
Paul
is,
George.
That tally for the history quiz is 50, Paul.
Oh, that's great. It's been a great run. It really has been.
Okay, we'll start with the criminal activity, but I was just wondering how we're going to cover from 1960 up till 2017 in 1 hour.
I don't know. We're going to have to.
It's a big topic.
We probably should have made it four instead of three, but we're kind of stuck.
We could have used just for the last 5 years, probably an hour. Okay, so I want to say, what was the early attraction of South Florida for criminals and crimes? What is the attraction of South Florida for criminals and crimes? What was it back then?
Well, back then it was desolate. So it was a great hideaway for people on the lam from the law. And they came to the area, whether it was a Civil War era or even before that or right after. There were hardly anybody living here. So if you wanted to take refuge, this was a place to come to. And in the case of the Civil War, Confederate leaders fleeing the United States, the Confederacy is part of the United States once again, came through Florida en route to the Bahamas or somewhere else. So, again, it's all about location. And even that far back, location played a role in crime.
Was there anything called law enforcement ever?
There was. The county was created in 1836. And at that point,
and included what's now Broward County.
Broward County, Palm Beach County, part of St. Lucie County, the northern part of the Florida Keys. It was a huge county at that time. It wasn't cut up until the early 1900s into what it is today. And you had the sheriff from Key West, which was Monroe County, sometimes looking in on what was going on here. But by the early 1840s, you began to see a procession of sheriffs for Dade County. So you did have a sheriff, usually with maybe one assistant, a deputy, and that was the extent of it. But keep in mind how far he had to roam from the northern Florida Keys to the St. Lucie Inlet in order to cover the crime in the area.
One sheriff. And one assistant.
So crime was minimal in a sense, but there were some serious crimes even during that time.
So the only way in really was by ship, unless you walked down the beach, and only the native peoples could really get around in the wildness of the Everglades.
Right. There were no roads otherwise, and it was just the water to bring you in, usually by boat. Yeah.
It's so hard to imagine looking at Miami today, to imagine these times when
skyline.
It was this desolate. Yeah.
Well, it was so desolate that in 1890 there were less than 900 people in Dade County. That same area today has more than 6 million people. So I always think when I'm in gridlock, which is frequent, that we've grown awfully fast in this community.
Yeah.
So what are some of the early lawbreakers? And let's talk about the first, say, murder spree.
Well, it's interesting, and I've written a history of the 11th Circuit Court and also the Dade County Bar Association. And in both of those assignments in the research, I found that there were some early lawbreakers. There was a there were two guys, Welsh and Wright, on a boat on the Miami River, and Welsh was upset because he was drunk, and Wright, who was his partner in bringing some starch to be processed upriver at a Kuti starch mill that you could use as flour in baking, he was upset because his rider wouldn't drink any of his rot gut booze. And so he mortally wounded him with whatever he had on the boat. Because he didn't drink. In other words, my booze isn't good enough for you.
Oh, I see.
And he was dragged to court. And he was convicted of what was homicide. That was 1851. And then your first mass murders in Dade County take place in late July of 1895 when a guy named Sam Lewis, living in Lemon City, and this is the frontier.
Now, he was a bartender, right?
He was. He was. And he was also, I mean, he did a lot of things, but he was also a marksman. He'd had a bar up in West Palm Beach, and he'd moved down to Lemon City. There was a fight in his bar, appropriately named the Lemon City Saloon. We're talking about Northeast 61st Street, what would be east of today's Biscayne Boulevard down to the bay. That was the main street. It was known as Lemon Avenue. I mean, this was Wild West.
Is it mostly known as a sawmill area?
Well, there were certainly sawmills, farms. It was really blue collar, just an interesting community. And I've always found it interesting that the U.S. population census taker said in 1890, there's no more frontier, because the way he looked at it was the frontier moved from east to west. But this was a frontier down here. There was nobody living here. And so there was a fight, and Lewis got banged up a little bit, and he warned these, if I see you again, your history. He killed two of the guys in the fight the next day. On Lemon Avenue, fled to the Bahamas, came back to the Miami area, and there was a kind of a posse waiting for him, exchanged fire, was wounded, and in the process of lying on the floor and being disarmed, he shot and killed somebody else. And eventually he was taken to what the county seat was in Juneau, today's North Palm Beach County. A mob goes up there, they kill the jailer, who was an African-American. They took Lewis, hanged him from a pole over a railroad track, and just riddled his body with shots. Five homicides, late July of 1895. It's the year before Miami became a city. So that's your first mass homicide. And again, it's Wild West.
So if you would drive down 62nd Street, go east of Biscayne Boulevard,
right,
towards the bay.
61st. Right.
So that'd be the area where that bar was.
Heart of Lemon City. You know, the sad thing is there's not even an historical marker that indicates that. That was the largest mainland community in southeast Florida in 1895 with over 350 people.
There was just that old post office there on 2nd Avenue.
Right. That would be a little farther west of there. Right. On about 62nd, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know what I didn't realize? When I was reading about this Sam Lewis killings and his hanging, it talked about him killing one of the posse that came after him after he killed Highsmith and Davis. And it said that was the first lawman in history that was ever killed.
I mean, in the county's history?
Probably
the county's history. And that is very true because he was deputized as part of that posse.
So that surprised me. I didn't know posse. I thought they were like mobs, posses. I didn't realize that they were actually deputized lawmen.
They're deputized lawmen, absolutely. Okay. So now they have police functions because we need you guys to apprehend this criminal. And what's interesting is the guy who was killed was Moretus Rhett McGregor. It sounds like Wyatt Earp. And, this is a frontier. He's buried at the Miami City Cemetery. And when I do my cemetery tours, we always stop there and talk about him. And he was a fair-minded guy. He wounded Lewis. Somebody said, you better just kill this guy. He's dangerous. He said, I can't do that. He's wounded. He's on the floor. He reached down to get his rifle. Lewis pulled out a pistol and shot and killed him. So, we've had a pretty bad start.
So that was 1895.
Summer, okay. Yes.
Let's turn a little bit later, say, when the city was incorporated in 1896 and then there on, we hear about the North Miami was such a crime-ridden area. But we're not talking about the city area of North Miami today.
Not at all.
But a little bit north of where we are now.
Right. Actually, it stretched roughly from 13th to 16th Street. So I think we're probably in North Miami.
In the middle of it.
Yeah. Right. From the
at 14th and 2nd Avenue.
Right. And from the bay west to at least today's Miami Avenue. And you had usually all three functions in one place: gambling, prostitution, and booze, because the city of Miami, from its inception, outlawed the sale of alcohol, with the exception of one thing: Henry Flagler's Royal Palm Hotel. Henry went out with a monopoly on that trade. He knew tourists would be coming down. He wanted to be able to sell alcohol to them. So these entrepreneurs said, that's fine. The city limits ends at what is today's 11th Street, then called 1st Street. So we'll just set up shop right outside of there. They have no jurisdiction over us. And that's what brought this about, which also brought Carrie Nation here, the Temperance Crusader, in 1908. And she used her axe against some of these wood frame buildings, probably pretty close to where we're sitting right now. To raise Cain against these bordellos, bars, and gambling dens.
Now, of the period we're talking about now, from the 1880s, say, up until 1910 or 15, are many of these people laid to rest in this Miami City cemetery?
They are. The earliest burials...
Which people should visit if they have a chance.
Oh, it's a fabulous place. I do a Halloween tour there every year. In fact, with History of Miami, I'm doing tour too this year.
I've even seen Paul's grave there. He's already got it bought.
Yeah, I know.
Yes, he does.
Well, no, you don't.
It's actually a member of the first mayor's family has proffered a grave to me. And when I was younger, I was completely freaked out. But as I got older, I said, it's not a bad idea.
Oh,
but
so
my parents are buried there, though.
And yeah. You can see his plot there.
Let's hope you don't occupy it anytime
no, I
soon.
No, I hope no time soon.
We'll go there at Halloween.
Exactly, which was when I was born, too. But the cemetery, Joe, Bonnie, housed really the first generation of Miamians. The cemetery became a cemetery in 1897, and there are victims of homicide there, but there's also people who were the perpetrators of homicide, and some of whom are buried in unmarked graves, potter's graves. They didn't have the money to be buried because the early folks convicted of capital crimes and sentenced to death were hanged at the county courthouse.
And where was the courthouse then?
A couple different places. One was on the north bank of the river just east of Miami Avenue until 1904. Then it's where today's courthouse is. And then today's courthouse opened in October of 1928. It's been there ever since. So that's where the hangings took place, in those couple of places.
And then they cart them up to Potter's Field.
Right. At Potter's Field and the city cemetery, a lot of those people that were hanged. And then in the 20s with the electric chair in Rayford, the executions then were moved from here primarily to Rayford.
All right, we're talking about crime and criminals from the late 19th century up until 1920 with Dr. Paul George. He's a resident historian at History Miami Museum. We'll be right back.
It's today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Dr. Paul George, the resident historian at the History Miami Museum. Paul George, at this period, say from the incorporation of the city of Miami and there on, address the racial violence that was going on. And of course, I think when the city was incorporated, nearly half of its residents actually signed the charter.
More than a third of those who voted for incorporation and signed a charter were African Americans working for the Flagler people primarily.
Were they Bahamian largely?
Many were Bahamians. Many came from points north of here in Florida. Others came from as far away as Georgia. And it was this was Deep South, racially in every other way. And they were relegated to a segregated area called Colored Town, east of the railroad tracks. From 6th Avenue to the city limits would be today's 11th Avenue, over to Northwest 7th Avenue, where David Beckham wants to build that soccer stadium. That would have been the western limits of Colored Town. And that was more undeveloped. There was more farming out there. But it was a dual system of justice, and they were just discriminated upon. If they represented 25% of the city's population, say in 1915, they represented probably 90% of those who were in jail. As opposed to prison, I mean the city jail. Mm-hmm. And there were just roundups, if you will, you know, for such ridiculous things as loitering and things of that nature. So they were really targeted. There were police raids in the area. And the hypocrisy was unbelievable because when Sheriff Hardy broke up North Miami in terms of prostitution, he and they pushed the prostitution into Colored Town. And so people started calling that Hardyville in honor of Sheriff Hardy.
A la Hooverville.
Exactly. Or Storyville in New Orleans, where Ralph Story, a councilman, had voted to break up a red light district that then moved somewhere else, and they named it for him, Storyville. So long story short, you had a lot of white patrons of that red light district, but you know, the police looked the other way in that respect when it came to that. But any time an African-American was considered to be out of control would be arrested.
And this is in Colortown.
This is in Colortown.
Okay.
Remember, there are no black policemen until 1944. And it's white policemen patrolling the area. And one of their chief functions was to keep the boundaries of Colortown where it was, despite the population growth, the so-called color line. The color line was an invisible line that separated the races, and they had to stay west of the railroad tracks, north of 6th Street.
So it was kind of like a ghetto.
Very much so. They're just confined to one area. Yeah. Now, again, they might work outside of the area.
There was even a wall there.
There were walls in different places, and as time went on, and this is the thing that's amazing, in the late 1930s, a wall was erected in today's Liberty City to block Liberty Square, to separate that on the west from points east of Northwest 12th Avenue, which was white, Lemon City.
Right.
And then another wall was built. This is unbelievable how late it was, 1948, in the Black Bohemian Grove, to separate the Charles Avenue side from the other side of the block. African-Americans on Charles Avenue, whites on the other side. So, you know, we're very deep south with everything that comes with that title.
And the conditions, the housing conditions in Colortown were nothing but deplorable.
Deplorable. And the property was owned primarily by white landlords. And that continued as late as the 1960s and 70s. Bonded rental agency owned thousands of little units. And most of the bathrooms through the late 1930s were outside. And there was a huge campaign by the Herald saying there's a lot of disease there. We got to clean this up. You begin to see some changes in terms of just, you know, the sanitation there.
Was plumbing, or they were outhouses?
They were outhouses, yeah, that late.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just it was a terrible situation. I think a lot of people think, well, Miami's a huge tourist center. It's way far away from other parts of the South, but it was very southern in terms of race, deep, deep south.
Going back to more specific crimes in this period we're talking about, probably one of the best known is the 1905 murder in the Everglades over the egret plumes.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Well, you had a man by the name of Guy Bradley, who was a game warden, and a federal law had been passed to prohibit people from decimating these snowy egrets because they were used in women's hats, the white feathers.
It was a big fad up north.
A huge fad, and if you looked at the hats of women during the Gilded Age and thereafter, I mean, they're, you know, it'd be kind of a balancing act just to wear these hats, not to mention how heavy they were. So, you know, he was trying to enforce things, and essentially, you know, he was killed in the line of duty as a result of that. And it was a huge issue. You know, you're going after a federal warden in that respect.
Did they catch?
Yeah, there was the villain was apprehended. Either Bradley or his brother, and I think it might be Guy Bradley himself, the victim of all this, is buried at the Woodlawn Park Cemetery. And there is a Bradley buried there, and I think it's Guy. But see, whereas most crime in terms of news of it was confined to this area, this became a national type of story.
Oh.
As opposed to most of the local crimes that went on.
What about John Ashley? He looks pretty colorful.
Well, the Ashley brothers were bank robbers terrorizing a three-county area, Palm Beach County, today's Broward, which was part of Dade County at the time, till 1915, and Dade County. And they didn't drive. They were on horseback. And Tommy Ashley got into a fight with a Seminole Indian and killed him. And he was incarcerated at the county jail, downtown Miami, site of today's county courthouse. His brothers wanted to spring him. Bob Ashley led the way. I mean, these were several brothers and also their associates. Broke into the jail, killed the deputy sheriff, who was the jailer, who had been tipped off by a prisoner. The deputy sheriff was a pretty humane guy. A guy had served his term, left, went to Texas. Apparently, he notified jailer Hendrickson, who's buried at the city cemetery, that the Ashleys are going to try to spring their brother, which should not have been surprising. And so what the deputy did was he put this iron door over the regular door. The jail sat immediately north of the county courthouse. It was in some ways attached to it. But he and his wife were dining that night, and he had the door open, I guess, for ventilation, and 1915. And it's interesting. They were eating a very healthy meal, though. Their entree and everything else was beans. So it had to be healthy. He was shot and killed in an exchange of fire with Bob Ashley. And Bob fled the jail, wasn't able to spring his brother, jumped in a car, didn't know how to drive, tried to convince one or two guys, you know, crank this thing up for me and help me get away. Couldn't, exchange fire with a policeman, a guy named John Riblett, and they were killed in the exchange of fire, the policeman and Bob Ashley. So this was another example of mass murder, but it's also one of the first, in this case, the deputy sheriff who was put away in the line of duty, buried at the city cemetery. A huge cause celeb, these types of things.
And he was known as, it says, the King of the Everglades or the Swamp Bandit.
There was sort of a Bonnie and Clyde
image
of him with his,
of course,
with his girlfriend. And
very much so. Very much so.
And who was she?
You know, her name escapes me right now, but I've read about it. And they hung out. They lived in the hinterland. So if they were robbing a bank or doing something else that was against the law, they always took refuge either in the edge of the glades or right in the glades itself. Yeah.
It
underlines the kind of Wild West nature of this place as we get into the 20th century. And, of course, the big change is the great real estate boom in the 20s. Now you've got an emerging metropolitan area. Now you've got, at least along the East Coast, a nationally renowned tourist resort. And so everything is changing by then. You've moved away from the frontier days.
What are some of the cons that were pulled? Like Flagler Street was famous for the binder boys on each corner,
right,
looking for tourists to sell property that was probably underwater.
Right, exactly. That was one of the major cons. And then, of course, there were the local real estate guys. See, the binder boys kind of swept in. They had a nose when there was a boom and people were speculating, and they could take advantage of speculation and then get out. But we also had a lot of locals who were selling land that may have been underwater. Once the Everglades began to be drained, beginning in 1906 off the New River, it just gave these great opportunities to salesmen, land salesmen. And they came in a big way. A guy named Richard J. Bowles would buy, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of acres of Everglades swampland and sell it through his salesmen. Sight unseen, big maps, Colorado, Nebraska, Missouri. The problem was the land wasn't being drained. People came down to Fort Lauderdale. There was so much pressure after people had bought land, thousands of people. We want to see what we have. And so Bowles and his people caved in 1911. Lauderdale at that time had not even 300 people. All these people, 4,000, came down to Lauderdale to see their land. The land was underwater. And I'm always amazed they didn't riot as a result of this.
That happened not that long ago, too. I mean, they've been doing it
1911,
ever since.
1911. And the drainage began in 06.
Right.
For people who were interested in the flavor of Miami at that time, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas was here at that time and working as a reporter for her father, who was the publisher of the then Miami Herald. But she wrote a lot of short stories about the binder boys and that era of Miami.
We should explain what the binder boys are.
Well, a binder boy was a huckster in many ways. The term binder means deposit. So he would buy a piece of land at 10% down, a binder. And then he would sell that binder at a dramatic markup because the cost of land, it was out of kilter with reality, was just ratcheting up so fast. And so he unloaded that thing within a matter of days, and he probably had made 100%, 200% profit on his binder or deposit. Then he went on and bought more and sold more. It was kind of like this big pyramid game.
And then the suckers went out to look at their land, and it was under 2 feet of water.
It could be under 2 feet of water, absolutely. And that's one of the things that was going on here. Marjorie came in 1915, and her descriptions of Miami, disembarking from the train at the train station downtown, you know, she'd never seen so much light in her life. She'd lived in New England and in Minnesota, and suddenly she's down here, and this light refracting off of the street was just unbelievable. But her story is such a great one in Miami.
Weren't there, you know, we didn't talk about when we were talking about all the racial, problems that were here, we didn't talk about lynchings.
There was a lynching in Homestead in the mid-20s. There was a lynching as late as 1935 in Fort Lauderdale of Reuben Stacy in a Piney Woods area somewhere around today's I-95 and Sunrise. As late as 1935, Florida had the dubious distinction of leading the nation for at least a few years in the number of lynchings, right up until an anti-lynching law was passed at the end of the 30s, beginning of the 40s.
We did a show, I can't
remember.
Yeah,
with the young woman.
Yes, what was her name? Oh.
It was on University Press of Florida.
About much more recent.
I'm sorry, I can't
lynchings.
Think of her name. I hope she's not listening.
I'm hoping I'm going to think of it before.
That's a fine press, it really is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a very academic study of lynching in Florida in the history of it.
Tamika Hobbs.
Dr. Tamika
Hobbs. Oh, I've seen it. Matter of fact, I read something on
Tamika
that.
Tamika Bradley Hobbs, I believe it was.
Yes.
Right. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Richard. Thank you. Thank you, Richard. Okay.
But getting back also, we haven't really touched on gambling in this early era of Miami and Fort Lauderdale.
Well, gambling is small time up until the 20s, and then you've got this plethora of tourists coming in. You got to keep them entertained. You got to keep them busy. And a lot of them liked it. They were unhinged from their roots back in New Jersey. Now I can do anything I want them down in Miami. And so gambling begins to be offered, but it really comes into its own a little beyond what we're talking about today, 30s and 40s, bring in the Kefauver Committee down in 1950. Gambling was adjudged to be, by the second half of the 30s through the 40s, probably the number one crime problem in Dade County.
But were there casinos before Prohibition, which started in 1919?
Yeah, Prohibition in Dade started in 1914, and then, of course, nationally in 1920. I can't really say casinos because it was illegal, but there was
backroom poker games.
Absolutely, backroom. For example, our beloved Ball and Chain. Miami Herald has a clip in 1940. Ball and Chain had been in business for 5 years then. And
what year is this? 1940?
1940.
Okay.
And they had a guard at the door in case the police came to raid it because there was gambling in the back. And so the Miami Herald's complaining that gambling is so out of control now and it's so brazen that the Ball and Chain has let go its guard because they're not fearful the police are going to come after them, probably because they believe the police were in collusion with them.
Right.
And the irony is that the sheriff of Dade County lived a block and a half away from the Ball and Chain at that time. So gambling becomes a huge thing, and it's everywhere, and it's in various forms.
Well, this is out of our era, but wasn't it true that the Miami Herald had a big crusade against illegal gambling at the same time that either John L., one of the Knight brothers, was an inveterate gambler? And
John he loved the horse races. But, of course, that was legal at that point, but he was an inveterate gambler. He was, yeah.
I want to talk about alcohol because I read this, I took this quote. Bootlegging was as much a natural tourist attraction as palm trees in the Atlantic Ocean.
And it's probably not an exaggeration. Somebody declared that Miami and South Florida was the wettest place in the United States during that time. And it was natural because the booze was coming in primarily from the Bahamas. Bimini's 50 miles away. And everything there was legal. And it was just an easy stone's throw to bring it in. That's what brings Al Capone to the area. Because a lot of his booze is coming from the Bahamas through Miami to points north.
What year did he come?
He came in the second half of the 1920s. Bought his home in Palm Island. It was already there. It was owned by a guy named Bush, Clarence Bush. And he added a lot to it and moved in the second half of the 1920s with his wife and son. And so that becomes, in many ways, the icon of Miami, Al Capone, you know, for all the wrong reasons. And it continues until his death. At the end of the 1940s, 1947.
Is his house still intact?
It's still intact. 93 Palm Avenue, a commercial pilot bought it in 1972 for $70,000. It was on the market 2.5 years ago, owned by an Italian firm, I think an LLC.
Let me guess. It was $70,000 in what year?
1972.
Okay, let me guess. $6
million. Over $7 million.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, pretty close.
Yeah, it was great. It was impressive.
Do we need to take a break? On today's Topical Currents, we're talking about crime history in South Florida with resident historian at History Miami Museum, Dr. Paul George. We're up until the 1920s today. It's a three-part series. We'll be right back.
And we return. It's today's Topical Currents with Dr. Paul George. It's our South Florida Crime History series. We're going to be doing this today, tomorrow, and Wednesday, and plotting the history of South Florida crime from the Civil War up until the present day. Well, right now, we're talking mostly in the 1920s, and we mentioned earlier Al Capone buying the home on Palm Island. Of course, many people think that was mostly to establish an alibi for the St. Valentine's Day murder, and he was there when that event happened in Chicago. But what else was going on with Capone, and how was he received in South Florida?
Well, it's an interesting story what happened. He said he moved down here because it reminded him of the sunny shores of Italy, but he'd never been to Italy. I think he moved down to be closer to the source of his liquor, plus the weather was great. He tried to ingratiate
himself. Pardon
me?
His son, too.
Son, too, yes. He tried to ingratiate himself with Miami's official, and he hired the son of two mayors. They were on his payroll. He had these big spaghetti and steak parties at his house without any booze, of course. He had a party, in fact, on the eve of the Valentine's Day Massacre in 1929 at his house. He was very visible the day of the massacre. He was down seeing the county solicitor, the head attorney for the county, that day at the courthouse. Everything was, he thought, was on the upswing until the massacre. And then he became persona non grata. In fact, Florida tried to, and you can't do this in the United States, somehow get him out of Florida and bar him from ever coming to Florida. The governor of Florida, Doyle Carlton, maintained a campaign like that. Well, it just can't happen. It's unconstitutional. And then he began to experience his problems in the 30s. He was put away once, twice, three different federal penitentiaries. He came out at the end of the 30s with tertiary syphilis, came back to his home. I mean, he was, you know, in a vegetative state, died of a massive stroke in 1947 at his home. But there's some great anecdotes about that. One time, Jack Sewell, who was the son of Miami's third mayor, was on his payroll, and Jack was a strapping young man, and Capone had like a trainer before we called them trainers, and he was working out with a medicine ball and all that. Capone was short and kind of squatty, but just rock hard. And so they would throw the medicine ball to him, and he would take it without any problems. And one day he told Jack Sewell, he said, put on some gloves, let's spar. Sewell was as nervous as a cat. You know, what if I hit this guy and hurt him? You know, I thought he would. And so, he was kind of tapping him. Capone says, no, just wind up and hit me as hard as you can. And so he just smashed him and the solar plexus, and it was like a wall. He realized how strong Capone was. But these kinds of things went on at his house. He had guards along. He built a wall around the house. He had guards patrolling that. It was a larger-than-life situation, and every Miamian has some kind of a story about Capone. And that has continued through these decades. If you talk about the Capone sightings, this man never slept and owned every piece of real estate in Miami. It just didn't happen that way.
But didn't he give a large donation to the city for some function, and one guy had to crawl back and actually tell Al Capone that we don't want your money, which must have been a pretty difficult thing to do.
It was very difficult. It was in the early stages of the Great Depression. And he was solicited by the Community Chest, a predecessor of today's United Way, for a donation. And one of the most civic, active citizens of Miami was the beloved Roddy Burdine, the great merchant prince of Burdines. So Roddy called on him, went over there to pick up some money. And it was a couple of thousand dollars, which today would be, I don't know, $50,000 or whatever. And he came back and he was so happy, you know, I've got this money. We can help these poor, depression-stricken citizens of Miami. The board of the Community Chest says, we can't touch that money. You know, it's blood money. You got to go back and take it back to Capone. And Roddy took it back somehow. It's just, I've researched their story. I've written the history of the Burdine family and interviewed his daughter. And she was a girl at the time, but she remembered the story, the trepidation in the household. And Roddy, being a noble person, didn't send one of his assistants from Burdine's there. He went back himself to return that money.
Roddy Burdine was quite a figure and had a very early death. Tell us.
He did. He ingested some non-pasteurized milk and died of that disease, brucellosis, that you get from that. He died at age 50 in 1936. But a great, great citizen. He's one of the founders of the Orange Bowl Festival, among many things. He was a real sportsman and always looking at ways to enhance Miami.
Okay. I want to ask, going back to the days of the bootlegging and the rum running, right, or I guess that was before it, but all the alcohol, it said that it was so wet in Florida that they were even serving it at official city functions. Where was law enforcement then?
Law enforcement was primarily on the take for a lot of that stuff. We had speakeasies along Flagler Street. People were selling bottles of illicit alcohol out of rumble seats of cars on Flagler Street, which was the main street. Law enforcement just wasn't around. And so many police were busted as a result. So many police leaders were forced to resign as a result. I mean, it's a huge problem. What gambling was from the late 30s on is what alcohol was up until the repeal of Prohibition in 1932. I mean, it was this huge problem. 1933, huge problem. It was just everywhere.
And so generally where there was alcohol, there was gambling and there was prostitution?
Usually so. And again, the prostitution, interestingly enough, was confined to the black area. But a lot of white patrons came to that neighborhood.
That's interesting in that the cops didn't arrest them, but they arrested the black.
Exactly.
Well, there had to be white prostitutes as well. They had to be working somewhere.
They're working in other places, but there wasn't like a clearly defined area, probably hotels more than anything else.
I want to talk about the KKK. Is this the birthplace of the KKK?
It's not, but the KKK arrived here early. It was reincarnated in 1915 in Stone Mountain, Georgia. We've heard a lot of talk about Stone Mountain and the figures in the mountain of different Confederate leaders and all. They had a fiery renaissance, if you will, in 1915 then. And then many chapters began to appear throughout the South. The KKK marched down Flagler Street, initially unannounced, in February of 1921. And nobody knows how large their numbers were, but that night alone, there were hundreds of them dressed from head to toe in white outfits. And soon they were terrorizing African Americans. There were two preachers, a Reverend Higgs, who was a Bahamian, who was preaching black equality, intermarriage of the races. And he was kidnapped in 1921 after a sermon and was tarred and feathered and forced to go back to the Bahamas. And then a white preacher in a black church in what was then called Colortown had the same experience, same year, 1921. Nobody was ever apprehended in the crimes. Tarred and feathered, thrown out of a speeding car, forced to go back to the Bahamas. Hmm. So the KKK ran rampant, and it's interesting, they pose as a law and order organization. They offered their services to the police as an ancillary police force. The St. Pete police accepted them as such. Miami police were forced to reject them. Miami police were bad. In the 1920s.
When you say
they were forced
to reject them, meaning they couldn't...
They couldn't use their offer to be an ancillary police force.
But when you say forced to, it's because they had to show that they weren't prejudiced or...
Well, I think there was just pretty strong opinion and probably among the city leadership, like, you know...
Can't do it.
These are hooded people.
Right.
But again, the police were just... I've got a quote from a grand jury hearing that, if we have time, I'd like to share with you. Just
sure.
Take a minute. Grand jury meeting in the late 1920s after the chief of police and his top lieutenants were indicted in a first-degree murder of a black prisoner. The grand jury investigated the police force, and they said the Miami Police Department has become, quote, a militant, tyrannical group that follows standards foreign to this country. It's a well-constructed organization of unknown strength within the department, slowly but surely destroying the freedom of our citizens, mean and cruel, practicing habits destitute of moral or civic virtue, and serving only to satisfy a malignant passion, end quote. So this is pretty scary stuff. And one police chief, H. Leslie Quigg, the most controversial of all the police chiefs, who was likely a member of the Ku Klux Klan, he admitted that they had used a primitive form of an electric chair in 1923 to extort confessions from prisoners.
It was the low-voltage model, I guess.
Yeah, the low-voltage, yes.
I guess it wasn't old Sparky.
Right. It was more humane.
The good electric chair.
And who knows where they placed those electrodes.
Exactly. Exactly. I don't want to think about it.
If you have any questions about this period of history, criminal history of South Florida, we have a little time. From the Civil War through the 1920s. For Dr. Paul George, you can call us 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@wlrn.org. We are with resident historian at History Miami Museum, Dr. Paul George, and we'll take a short break. When we come back, hopefully you'll be taking your calls.
And we return. It's today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman, Joseph Cooper, and, of course, Dr. Paul George. He's our favorite Topical Currents historian, the resident historian at the History Miami Museum, a prolific author. Also, Paul still teaches. You're not affiliated with the college anymore.
Right.
But you are teaching courses at the museum.
I am in Miami, South Florida history, and we'll be offering a 5 Thursdays beginning in early October into early November, and it's been fun. It's chronological approach to Miami, South Florida history, but also topical, you know, personalities, events, issues, and we encourage people to consider taking it. They can call History Miami at 305 375-1621 for information.
Well, maybe I could take that. There aren't any tests on that, right?
I think you'd do really well on that, actually.
I think you could teach it with you.
I didn't dare take the college course because I knew there were tests, but at the museum there weren't.
You can certainly take it. There's no test at all. It'd be fun.
But Dr. George also does walking, boating, busing, biking, trains.
Skateboards.
And train tours.
I've done Segway tours too, yes.
Oh, okay. Yes. All right. And you can find out about the tours by...
HistoryMiami.org. We'll list the tours. I've got a boat tour coming out of Coconut Grove this Sunday evening, in fact. And they could call the same number, 375-1621, for that.
So you leave Dinner Key?
We leave Dinner Key. I'm going to skirt along the coastline, past Vizcaya, the old Millionaire's Row, the new Brickell of today, probably to the mouth of the river and back.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Should be fun.
Okay, let's take a call or two. We've got Jim in Coral Gables. Jim, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Good afternoon, hosts and distinguished guest, Dr. George.
Thank you.
I belong to a little fishing club on what is called Hibiscus Island, the Rod and Reel Club.
Right, of course.
And can you tell me, I'm told I was the club's youngest owner member when I joined at 24 years old. But part of the lore and the history and the attraction of joining, I understand it was Al Capone's old club Lido. And we had in the ballroom, we still had the original gear that you could twist almost like a jalousy that would roll back what they called a moonroof that was over the dance floor. Can you shed some light on that, Dr. George?
Well, it certainly was a nightclub. I don't think Capone owned it. But I'm not certain. There was a Club Lido on Belle Isle that was very, very popular going back to the middle decades of the 20th century. But the nightclub then morphed into the Rod and Reel Club, which was a fantastic organization. Roddy Burdine, among others, was a member of that. And that was, years before you joined and even decades before, that was really old Miami and old Miami leadership in that club. I had the good fortune of speaking there about 10 years ago, and it was a great experience just being over there. But it went from a nightclub to Rod and Reel, and, of course, unfortunately, it went down not too many years ago after the club closed.
Right. They ran into financial difficulty, and I was fortunate enough at a period of time I was the program chairman. So I was the type of person that would have asked you to come speak. I wish I had known of you at the time. But
okay, Jim, we have a lot of callers. Thanks for your call.
Thank you very much. Have a great afternoon.
Thank you, Jim.
Okay, thanks, Jim. Ralph from Miami has two questions for you.
Okay.
Can you discuss the Tea House Plantation, now Legion Park, and the illegal activities that went on there?
Well, Mr. Ogden built a house that would represent today the Tea House Plantation going back to the early 1900s. And again, as we mentioned before, Dade County became dry in 1914 through a wet, dry election in the previous fall. And he certainly dispensed, both among friends and for profit, if you will, alcoholic drinks within the Tea House Plantation House. But it was a pretty picturesque place, too.
And he also wants to know if you know anything about Al Capone being arrested for the first time in South Florida as he left an American Legion boxing match.
He was hauled down with hardly any evidence of anything going on, and he always had great mouthpieces, including a man named Vincent Giblin, who later became a circuit court judge, a brilliant attorney at the University of Notre Dame. And Giblin and others would usually spring him, but the charges were always so spurious. He really faced a lot of harassment here, and I understand because he was so-called public enemy number one. But every time he turned, it seemed like they were hauling him in for something. The charges never stuck.
Well, he had, of course, friends as judges, so that didn't hurt.
He certainly did, and you're right about that. You're right about that.
Okay, another quick call. Armando, Miami Beach. Hi.
Happy eclipse, gentlemen.
Okay.
Thank you.
And ladies.
Oh, and lady, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I wanted to ask about Belle Isle.
Sure.
J.C. Penney had his home there.
He did, uh-huh.
And Herbert Hoover came down as president-elect. That part I know is true.
The rest
of the story, I don't know if Al Capone kept him up all night and that's how the Untouchables wound up in Chicago.
I don't know about that either, but you're right about JCPenney's home there. Belle Isle was, to look at it today, it's essentially high-rises, many of which were built as early as the 1960s and all, but there were so many beautiful single-family homes that were the winter homes of high rollers in American finance and industry. And it was those guys that really helped organize clubs that would raise money for charitable endeavors. I mean, they really had a charitable side to them while they spent their winters here. And Belle Isle was really ground zero for it. Incidentally, that is the only natural island in Biscayne Bay in that region. Everything else around it is built in terms of islands, including the Port of Miami, of course.
So you're talking about like Dalito and...
Dalito, that's created in 1925, 26. Okay. All of that, Hibiscus and all of those are all built islands, dredged out of shallow bay bottom.
And the ones up around 79th Street and Miami Shores.
Right, when they built the causeway that's in Miami Shores, they built those islands for Miami Shores. Exactly.
The Shoreland, right?
The Shoreland Corporation, yes. He's going to do really well in that course.
Yes, he will.
There's no
he
doubt
will.
About it.
I think you should
How about
give him a test.
During this, kidnappings and abductions during this period, anything going there?
Well,
of course, this was before Lindbergh.
Right. I'm going to mention one thing, though, Joe, and it kind of talks to what you're asking right now. The crime rate in Dade County in 1925-26 in terms of homicides, accidents, accidental death, was 3.5 times what it was during the so-called Paradise Lost period of 1980-81.
During the cocaine cowboy era.
Right, cocaine cowboy, and also just, you know, everything that came, the riots and the Muddy Hill boat lift. That's how lawless the area was, and it's a lot of people coming down to speculate in real estate or just getting away from their home base, and I think feeling unhinged and maybe feeling like they could act with impunity. So crime just soared during that time.
Attracted to drifters. And...
It did. In fact, it's interesting also that the suicide rate was more than 3 times what it would be in the early 1980s. And again, it's a lot of unhinged people coming down here at that time.
Not anymore, though.
No, not at all. We've cleaned up our act completely. Completely.
Let's. You have more email, or Bonnie?
No.
Okay, let's go to Lake Worth caller. This is Rene.
Yeah. Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, yes. I work for Florida Power and Light Company, and I would listen to your show at my lunch hour. Make sure my lunch hour is that when you guys are on. Great show. You mentioned about, Doctor, that the Al Capone went to Italy, but he never did. He built his home in Miami and named it. And why did he name that? I don't know the name. I've heard it before said. We can't find the information. What was the name of his home?
You know, I don't know if it had a particular name. It was a home that was there, and he certainly enlarged it, built what today we call a master bedroom on it, and added a wall, added a big cabana there. I'm not familiar with a name to the house.
Yeah, he named it, yeah.
Well, he had a beloved wife, May, but I've never heard it referred to as May before. So maybe that's something that we need to dig up.
Okay.
Yeah, how could I find that information or find you off the air or contact? I'd like to do that coconut trip.
Coconut Grove trip. Well, give us a call at 305-375-1621, and somebody there would be happy to help you, and then I can personally meet and greet you on Sunday.
Okay, 305-375-1621.
Exactly.
Please find you. Maybe we can dig that up.
I would love it. Would love to
Thank
do
you.
So.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Paul,
you.
We're getting very close to the end of the program, but we brought up Capone. I wanted to address that his son, who we called Sonny.
Right.
And was deaf, and I believe he was a classmate of Desi Arnaz in high school.
He was. He went to Jesu for 1 year, then he went to St. Pat's. And Desi came in the 1930s from Cuba, his father and mayor of Santiago, and moved to Miami Beach, and they were classmates, which is so interesting to have those two personalities there.
St. Patrick on Miami Beach.
Miami Beach, yes, the Catholic school over
there. Desi Arnaz was a classmate.
About 30, whatever it is, 38th Street.
Okay.
Yes, yes. Yeah, Desi and Al Capone Jr.,
well, let's do a little promo for tomorrow's edition.
Okay.
It'll be part two, and we'll begin in about 1930 and go up into the 1960s. So what are some of the highlights, Paul?
Sounds good. Sounds good. Well, we're going to be looking at something that could have changed the course of history, an assassination attempt on Franklin Roosevelt. We're going to look at a lover's triangle murder situation in the early 1930s. We're going to look at something that's really kind of sad, and that was the kidnapping and murder of a young boy out in Princeton, Florida in 1938. And then just this onset of gambling that would lead to the creation of the Greater Miami Crime Commission and the Kefauver Committee hearings televised in 1950 in downtown Miami.
And Meyer Lansky.
And Meyer Lansky, of course, being part of the scene both before World War II.
And Barbara Mackel.
And Barbara Mackel in 1968. And
that's where else but on public radio.
Right. Where else but in Miami, South Florida. Thank you, resident historian at History Miami Museum, Dr. Paul George. You can find out about all his tours at historymiami.org or 305-375-1621, also about his classes. Thank you.
Thank you.
See you tomorrow.
Thank you, Bonnie. Looking forward to it.
And thank you for tuning in for today's Crime History Program. Topical Current's lead producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction today from Michael Stock. Polly Landis is associate producer. And if you'd like to hear the whole program or link it to a friend, it's easy to download them free at our website, WLRN.org.
And we want to thank Peter Jay, who's been putting the shows up on our website every day in lieu of Jason right now.
Also, we have the TC Facebook page and the iTunes podcast. Tomorrow at 1, we resume our South Florida Crime History Program series with Dr. Paul George. We'll focus on the wide open period beginning in the 1930s at the height of alcohol-related crime. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, stay tuned for Here and Now next on NPR News.